from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Starting Saturday, tens of millions of Americans will begin watching the Final Four, the culmination of this year's men's college basketball tournament. But those viewers aren't the only millions that matter. The tournament is also worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The NCAA, the governing body of collegiate athletics, nets $700 million each year from television rights, money that fuels high-priced salaries for coaches, but doesn't provide a paycheck for the athletes who actually play the game. That incongruity is the focus of a PBS Frontline story that airs this weekend on KQED. Should college athletes be paid? We'll take up the debate over big bucks and basketball after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The Final Four gets underway this weekend, the grand finale of this year's men's college basketball tournament. And when Connecticut faces off against Kentucky in one of tomorrow's two semifinal games, it will feature two longtime college basketball powerhouses with coaches who each make millions of dollars a year. The tournament itself takes in $700 million each year in television rights alone. But what about the people on the court, the ones we pay to watch, the college athletes who play the game? They don't get paid. Though most do get the not insubstantial benefit of a free college education, we still call them student athletes, though sometimes the student part can also be called into question. Take tomorrow's semifinal game. Connecticut graduates just 31% of its players, Kentucky 44%. The contradictory nature of big-time college sports is the focus of a new Frontline story that airs Sunday night on KQED television Channel 9 called Money and March Madness. And that is also our topic for this hour of Forum. Joining us, Lowell Bergman. He is the producer correspondent for the PBS story we just referenced on Frontline. He's also a professor of investigative reporting at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Lowell Bergman, nice to have you with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us, too, is Sonny Vaccaro. He is a former executive at Nike, Reebok, and Adidas and played an ongoing role in the development of basketball and how it became a big-moneyed activity. Sonny Vaccaro, thanks for being with us as well.
Very, very pleased to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit first, Lowell Bergman, about the money that's involved. I mentioned the television contract alone with CBS and Turner is $700 million a year, which adds up to $10.8 billion over 14 years. How large a money enterprise should we think of college sports as being?
The runner-up to the Super Bowl. Basically, it's the second largest athletic event in terms of money, advertising, et cetera, going in this country.
And where does that money go?
Well, the NCAA's share of the money, they say that 90-odd percent of the money goes back to the member schools, mostly three-quarters of that or more to what's called the NCAA Division I schools. And then it goes to pay salaries of NCAA people at the headquarters and as well championships in non-revenue sports, I believe 88 sports nationally.
I want to come back to that last part because that's part of the argument for why this money is necessary, that it helps subsidize all the other sports. But staying with the big money for a moment, I mentioned the coaches tomorrow. John Calipari's coach at Kentucky, for example, I believe he makes something like $4 million a year. Don't know what Coach Calhoun makes at Connecticut, but also in the million-dollar-plus range. Is that how common is that, or is that not at all the norm?
It's very common in the major programs in the United States, both basketball and football.
And what interested you in that in this story? Is it this counterintuitive situation where you have the people who are coaching and administrating make the money and the workers don't? I mean, what was it that drew you to wanting to tell this particular story on Frontline?
Well, two different reasons. One is the obvious contradiction here that you have something called amateur sports with billions of dollars involved. And as Michael Lewis points out in the interview we did in the piece, the players don't get paid. And I couldn't think of another system like this anywhere in this country, and it turns out no one else in the world does it this way in terms of developing athletes, having athletic competitions, whether it's amongst school-age people or higher education. So this is a very unique system that's grown up over the last 100 years. That was interesting to me, combined with the fact of being a veteran of over 2 decades in commercial broadcast news organizations. I know that you couldn't do this story at a network level, CBS, ABC, 60 Minutes, you name it.
Because they get in so much, they have such an investment that
they're suppliers.
Themselves.
They're suppliers. CBS will not be running a story about the players not being paid during March Madness, for sure, and I doubt in the coming year.
Sonny Vaccaro joins us as well, along with Lowell Bergman, who's a principal character in the story that you told, Lowell Bergman. And Sonny Vaccaro, thanks for being with us. You played this role in kind of bringing money into college basketball. Describe how you went about doing that.
I imagine I was the first person to understand that business operates on a different street than everyone else, because I merged amateurism with commercialism. There's no denying that, and I was part of it. And me and the man at Nike, Phil Knight, who owns the company, understood what it would be to glorify our product, which were Nike shoes and apparel in the 70s. So I did have a major part in this commercialization, and I still have a vocal interest in it, because as I've seen it grow. One thing was always consistent with me that never was with the public is that the universities were a willing partner to our enterprise. There's no question. They accepted our money, however it was delved out to their coaches and their universities since 1977. You cannot deny this. They knew what they were doing, and they know what they're doing now.
I want to get to how you've had a change of heart and how you view this issue differently, but describe again how this basically worked, that you had this idea that, gee, if you just took a shoe like Nike, got kids to wear it, paid coaches to encourage that. Walk through how that deal originally took place and what it grew into.
Well, if you go back to 1977, there was no commercialization anywhere. Advertising on the local radio show or the TV, because sports were not popular, other than what Lowell said. Even the Super Bowl at that time was just coming into glorification. So certainly college basketball and later professional basketball were an antidote. And when ESPN started in the 80s, the early 80s, they were televising games from West Coast on tape delay at 3 in the morning. So the public was only interested in their geographical hero, whether it be the high school team, the summer team that represented their neighborhood and local games and that, and obviously their college team. And I, because of my, I was involved since the 60s in a national high school game out of Pittsburgh that was very successful called the Dapper Dan Rombaugh Classic, I saw the intense interest, especially in the East Coast, especially from Chicago East. There was no question that these kids and these teams held the interest. So I explained to Phil Knight that if he really wanted to get into making money for his basketball, for his shoe company, go to basketball, which he only had one school, the University of Oregon, which Phil graduated from, wear the shoe. They were a track and field company and just starting selling shoes out of the box. They're a $25 million company in the early 70s. So saying that, I convinced them that if we paid the coaches, gave the shoes away to the universities, we would then get our shoes on the feet of these kids and these athletes, whether they be in college or in high school or summertime, and the public would see it. And I explained to him, my idea in the 70s was get your photo on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Because in the 70s and the early 80s, Sports Illustrated is different than it was today. That was the Bible of sports. And if you had your picture on the cover, you made it. You did. And so that was the beginning of it.
Sonny Vaccaro, former executive at Nike, Reebok, and Adidas, who played a key role in the development of money and the role that it plays today in collegiate sports. I want to focus now, though, on who doesn't get paid. We've just heard how coaches get paid for shoe contracts and, of course, wind up making these enormous salaries. Athletes themselves do not. But they do get, and let's hear a clip from your film, Lowell Bergman, that makes the argument about what athletes do get. This is Mark Emmert, who is the president of the NCAA, former president of the University of Washington. And the argument that he makes that you will now hear is that athletes do get something substantial, even though they don't get a paycheck.
We provide them with remarkable opportunities to get an education at the finest universities on earth, that's American universities and colleges, to gain access to the best coaches and the best trainers to develop their skills and abilities. So if they have the potential, that small proportion, to go on and play in professional sports, we're helping them develop those skills and they can go do it. If they choose to not go on, or if they don't have those skills or abilities, then they get to go on in life and be successful as a young man or a young woman.
Mark Emmert speaking in Lowell Bergman's story, Money and March Madness. Again, that airs on Frontline this Sunday on KQED Channel 9, Sunday at 7 o'clock. So that's the argument, Lowell Bergman, and it's not an inconsequential benefit. If an athlete goes to Stanford University down the road, they're getting a lot. They're getting a great education. They're getting full room and board support. They're getting tutoring if they need it. They're getting sports equipment. They're getting a great degree if they're there for all 4 years. And most athletes at Stanford do, in fact, graduate. We'll get to graduation rates a little bit later on. That's not a small thing.
Well, unfortunately, Stanford's the exception that proves the rule. And most of the schools, the graduation rates are not that high. 16 of the teams that are playing in March Madness this year have graduation rates below 50%. And later in the interview, President Emmert acknowledges that's not acceptable. He does mention in passing the small proportion who go on. And that small proportion is 1.2% of the players ever making it into the NBA. So it's a very, very narrow group, small group, who are going to make a lot of money out of this in the end. And what they're there for, what they're being paid a scholarship for, which, by the way, averages $3,000 less than they need to make it through the year nationally when you look at the numbers, what they're there for really is to promote their basketball careers. They're just on loan. They're stopping off in most cases. If they can make it to the NBA, that's where they want to go, and that's where they do go.
But isn't the answer then to try to focus on making sure that a place like Stanford, and there are many other places that do a good job of this, University of Illinois does a good job, a real basketball powerhouse, University of North Carolina does a good job, has an 88% graduation rate. Isn't the solution then to focus on that, to try to make sure that kids actually stay in school?
By the way, be careful about the graduation rate numbers. What we found in doing this reporting is that it's almost impossible to explain the system that they use to calculate these numbers, first of all. Secondly, it doesn't take into effect the quality of the classes that they're taking in many of these schools where they have specialized majors and classes that are set up. Because understand that doing this job and doing it every day as basically a semi-pro or pro athlete, you're spending 5 hours a day doing it, the ones that we've talked to who have been at all successful at it. And they're often traveling for weeks on end all over the country. So they're not even at the campus. So there's a different – we're talking about NCAA Division I men's basketball, not talking about the 200, 300 some odd thousand other athletes.
Right. But Sonny Vaccaro, wouldn't that – if you could solve that problem and understood that it is difficult to track graduation rates and these kids do put in an enormous amount of time when they're playing Division I sports, but if you could hold people up to a certain standard, whether that's Stanford's or North Carolina's or whoever's, wouldn't that then be a fair bargain? If kids stayed in school, if they got a degree that had value, and that degree were in fact paid for, I think there are a lot of parents listening to this problem, probably a lot of kids who would say, I'll take that.
You know, but as Lowell said, you're being misleading because you're basically saying, you're assuming that all the kids graduate. And I notice, and I have no concrete evidence, but I notice you left out Cal. I would question Cal's graduation rate of its athletic program. And I just know from the peripheral. And I, you know, what happens here when you include the basic number of all these universities, it sounds good. But in no other aspect of society do the smallest group of individuals provide for the whole. Why is it that we proclaim that these kids should share their wealth? And that's fine with me. I'm not opposed to anything. I'm not opposed to Title IX or helping these kids get an education. What I'm opposed to are the people who generate the revenue, as Lowell said so well, that these kids are the ones who are going to suffer academically. We do not have statistics that tell you the obscene classes they take. And if they happen to get a degree, which I don't know that they do or they don't, it is also flawed by the inclusion of some unbelievably wonderful academic institutions that fall under the umbrella. I'm sure the Ivy League falls under there. Well, those quotas are probably 100% across the board. I'm sure all the schools, the small schools that make up Division I, those kids probably do graduate. I'm not going to hit on that. I'm sure, and it's wonderful that you get an education. I'm just questioning why so small a group pays for the whole of the group entirely, and such a small group who's not guaranteed they're going to get that education. Because I know for a fact, and Lord didn't go into, there's a major university in this country that offers a degree in housing. A real estate, nothing wrong with being in real estate. It's a wonderful profession, okay? They probably know more than the people who took the curriculum with a housing degree at one of our leading universities, state university. So my point here is, it's a flawed argument, because whoever is the president, and it's not the president's fault, they're giving the Pollyanna example of what education is. Yeah. They're not giving the reality.
Sonny Vaccaro, former executive at Nike, Reebok, and Adidas, who is featured in the story that Lowell Bergman was the correspondent for the PBS documentary series Frontline. That story, Money and March Madness, airs Sunday on KQED Channel 9, Sunday at 7 o'clock. Joining us as well now to get an additional perspective on this topic is Andrew Zimbalist. He is an economics professor and sports economist at Smith College in Massachusetts. His latest book is Circling the Best Bases, Essays on the Challenges and Prospects of the Sports Industry. Professor Zimbalist, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Dave.
Add in to your perspective on this question and whether or not, if you could improve graduation rates and kids actually got their degrees, whether or not that would be a fair bargain, or whether or not you view that really the only way to be fair about this would be to pay them for what they do on the court.
Well, okay. I think that it's important to be careful about whom we're speaking, because if we're talking about the starting five on the basketball team or the starting 22 on the football team, or even within that group, the star quarterback, the star end, the star tackle, whatever, then it's quite clear in the top level of Division I, which is these days called FBS, that those kids are creating value for the school that varies between several hundred thousand dollars and a couple of million dollars, or even several million dollars a year. Even if they do get the full value of their college education, even if they went to classes and did their own work and went to real classes and ended up graduating, even if all of those things, they're getting a value that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 a year from the school. And they're producing value that's several hundred thousand to several million dollars a year. So those star players at the top level are definitely not getting a fair shake. When you go down, though, from those players, you start talking about the second string on the football team and the third string, because, you know, the average FBS football team has 85 scholarship players, and then they have 32 walk-ons. So they have actually 117 average players in FBS, the top 110 schools. And in basketball, of course, you've got a second string sitting on the bench. You've got 14 players on the team. Those people, it's not at all clear that they're being economically exploited by the scholarship they get. And as Sonny was suggesting a moment ago, the white upper-class males on the tennis and golf team who are getting scholarships, they're not being exploited because they don't create any economic value for the school, and so on and so forth for the additional 15 or 20 sports that you'll find at a typical Division I school. So I'm certainly not making the claim that all college athletes are exploited. We're talking about a small number, and those for whom you can make that argument, a reasonable share of those are looking at having some kind of a professional career. And if they don't make it to the NBA or the NFL, then maybe they'll become college coaches or they'll have some career connected to what they were doing.
But that raises a really interesting question, which is how do you begin to differentiate? If you have the star on the basketball team who's averaging 20 points a game and leading his team into the tournament, do you say, okay, well, he's creating value of a certain amount, we'll pay him that, but the guy who's the backup point guard or the center who doesn't score and can barely rebound, we're going to pay him a lot less? How do you figure that out?
Well, you don't. I'm not advocating that we create a labor market for these college athletes. I would say that what we need to do, and by the way, I don't think that the colleges can afford to pay these guys what they're generating, because A lot of the money that they generate is going to subsidize the other sports, and a lot of the money that they generate is going to pay coaches obscene salaries, like Calipari, $4 million plus $550,000 additional if he wins March Madness, and endless millions of dollars from other contracts on the side. Those are numbers that are completely unjustifiable economically and ethically. They're obscene. So there's a lot that gets pushed aside, and other people are getting financed by the fact that we don't pay the stars. But I wouldn't advocate that you create a player's market. I don't think it works. We can't afford it. It's against the culture that we have in college. When somebody comes to college, they pay their tuition, room and board, and they have equal access to classes. They have equal access to all of the activities at the school. We don't pay the leading thespian in drama productions. We don't pay the first violinist when the school orchestra plays Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, even though you might charge to get into those events. So I think it's the wrong way to go about it. I think in order to lessen the exploitation of these athletes, what we ought to be doing is, first of all, the NCAA ought to do is to raise the limit on the scholarship so that you can, and Lowell was referring to this, instead of giving them tuition, room, and board and nothing else, or $15 for laundry, you give them the full cost of attendance, which is about $3,000 higher than what the scholarship is. You allow them to use their athletic school's skills in the summertime. We allow students who are studying chemistry to get a job in a lab and be paid in the summertime, but we don't allow, the NCAA does not allow student athletes to go to a summer camp and earn money at a summer camp. And there are lots and lots of other examples. One of them comes from a suit that Sonny is now involved with around athlete publicity rights. So I think the NCAA applies a false definition of amateurism. It's arbitrary. It's forever being morphed and tweaked to suit their purposes. But if they did it consistently and had a real eye on improving the experience of the student athletes, then that would be the way to go, rather than saying, let's create an open labor market.
Andrew Zimbalist, economics professor at Smith College. Again, his latest book is Circling the Bases, Essays on the Challenges and Prospects of the Sports Industry. And his comments are also included in Lowell Bergman's story, Money in March Madness. Professor Zimbalist, thanks for adding your point of view to our program.
Sure.
What about the suggestions that you heard Andrew Zimbalist make, Lowell Bergman, which is changing it around the edges, not paying him because of all the complexities that he suggested, but just allowing a little bit higher cap on what that scholarship includes, allowing kids to work in the summer? Would that be sufficient in your judgment?
Well, first of all, one correction is that Zach Stauffer is the producer of this broadcast, just that's on Frontline. The question which Professor Zimbalist brought up and actually did in our interview is the notion that what's happened is that the NCAA, in his view, has become a sort of trade association for coaches and athletic directors, that they are getting the economic benefit from the extra value created by players who are either stars or successful. So we have that basic imbalance going on in all of this. In terms of additional funds, I noticed in the wake of the story, President Embert is now saying that they're going to take up the question of possibly distributing some more money to the players to make up for this shortfall.
We have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll open up our phone lines to hear all of you, and you'll hear more from Lowell Bergman's story, the Money in March Madness piece, which airs on KQED television at 7 o'clock on Sunday. We'll also hear more from Sonny Vaccaro and Andrew Zimbalist. I'm sorry, I thought you had to leave us, but if you can stay with us, that would be great. We'll let you chime into our conversation and take questions as well. Here's the number if you want to join in. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at form@kqed.org. Should college athletes be paid, or should they get a higher stipend to contend with the costs that they endure? What's your view on this? Are you going to be watching this Sunday, or do you feel like college sports has become not anything like what you think amateur athletics ought to be about? We'd like to hear your point of view in our conversation. 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the big business of college sports. We are approaching the Final Four in men's and in women's basketball, but it is men's basketball that generates so much money. And the question is, should athletes in some way share in that enormous amount of revenue that is generated by the Final Four, the NCAA tournament in particular, some $700 million a year in television rights? We're joined by Lowell Bergman, who is a professor of investigative reporting at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and also the correspondent for the new story out that will air this weekend on KQED at 7 o'clock on Sunday, a piece called Money and March Madness. Andrew Zimbalis, economics professor at Smith College, is here too. And Sonny Vaccaro, former executive at Nike and Reebok. Both Sonny Vaccaro and Andrew Zimbalis were also interviewed in Lowell Bergman's story. We'd like to hear from you. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Should college athletes be paid, or are there other things that could reform the big business that college athletics has become? Sonny Vaccaro, why don't you jump back in on this? You heard Andrew Zimbalis describe some of the complexities and difficulties that would be involved in paying student athletes some sort of rate pay, but there are other things that could be due, upping the amount of scholarships and so on. What do you think should be done in terms of reforming the current system?
Well, the first thing I want to say up front, I think it's impossible to, we're not the Army paymaster to pay these kids after every game. There's no question about that. What I'm trying to advocate, what I would like to see done, and Andrew has the sense of scholarship and, you know, the monetary reward to reach that would help. That would be a start. What is obscene in my case, more obscene than even figuring out the morass of paying them while they're still playing, is the sense of entitlement that the NCAA thinks they have of their images forever. That is beyond reproach to me. And I think the four-year scholarship, even though, you know, Mr. Emmerich and others, you know, have pleaded to the public that we're giving them an education, well, for the edification of this to your public, there's no guaranteed education there because the scholarship and the reward is 1 year at a time. So when you say a four-year scholarship, you're implying that they're going to be there 4 or 5 years to get their degree. That's not true.
You mentioned
that is so flawed, it's ridiculous.
And again, that comes back to this question of graduation rates. Let me just repeat a couple of others, and then I want to come back to the other point you mentioned. University of Arizona graduation rate, and again, as Lowell Bergman suggests, these are difficult numbers to get clear exactly what they mean. But the ones that were published in a University of Central Florida study indicate University of Arizona, 20% graduation rate. And I'm just giving West Coast schools here. University of Washington, 44%. USC, 42%. University of California, Santa Barbara. These are all basketball programs that had teams in the tournament, all with graduation rates substantially under 50%. But let me ask you about the suit that you're a part of. This has to do, and you mentioned this, the image. Student athletes, even after they graduate, don't get any residuals from, let's say, a video game that uses their image. What is it that you're challenging in court along those lines?
Well, the O'Bannon case goes right to the point.
This is Ed O'Bannon, a former UCLA basketball player.
Once they are no longer playing, whether they graduated or they did not, there's no human, you know, thought process here that could extend to them their image and their value to that particular thing that they sold, whether it be a film, a game, a picture, beyond their being at that university. What other than the entitlement of this organization, the NCAA, thinking they have over these kids forever, is beyond comprehension. We can sit and argue Andrew's case on what we're doing while they're playing. Other people have got good questions. But this one is without argument. These kids are no longer there. And I basically got really interested, and I've been an advocate in my way, and even though I've been on the other side of the fence giving the money, and I've admitted to that since day one in 1977, I gave my own personal check, just so we all understand this, and Phil reimbursed me. So there's no hiding my role in this, none. But never have I ever, you know, try to take away the value of the athlete. I said on this show that the athletes do we, and I did that because we get to choose on the feet of the kids. My point on the O'Bannon case is, do you understand they've been selling these things even before there were, you know, classic sports, EA Sports. They just felt you go to their website and you'll see all the teams that played in the NCAA Final Four for sale.
So again, these are athletes who Ed O'Bannon played more than a decade ago.
Yes,
and
right.
Even though he has long since passed college, he still gets no benefit from his image being used on video games. Let's hear what some of our listeners think and hear their point of view on this topic. Doug in Oakland joins us first. Doug, go ahead.
Hey, great. And I want to thank you, Professor Zimbalist. You're a classy guy. I understand exactly what you're saying. And what I want to say is a Division I basketball player, we were the only game in town, and I would see my pictures on 7-Eleven Slurpee cups. But the biggest thing is all the illegal stuff that goes on. Boosters have to, you know, the booster handshake, in which they have to shake your hand and give you $400 or $500. One of the boosters owned a car company, but he couldn't give me the car directly, so I'd have a girlfriend to pick it up, and she drove it in her name, you know, and it's just illegal. We're getting paid, but we're just not getting compensated. It's like sharecropper.
Were you a former Division I athlete?
Yeah.
And where did you play?
It's the norm.
Where did you play, Doug?
I played in one of the mountain states.
Okay, and you're talking
but
about,
you know,
so
I'm,
all this, yeah, you got paid, but it was never above board.
It was never above board. Cars,
yeah.
Yes, but it had to be. You had to give it to your girlfriend's name. You know, they say tell her come pick a car up. And that way, I got a car, and if anyone checked it out, it was in her family's name. Or the handshake is the norm. I mean, that's just, you know, you just walk around and, you know, you score some certain amount of points, and you know you go down to the pizza shop and they give you back $500. You only gave, you know, you didn't even pay for the pizza. It's all illegal.
So Doug, you got paid and you got a car. It's just that none of it was anything that anyone openly acknowledged, correct?
Yeah. 32 games a season, not counting practices, and they tell you you're a student, but I'm on a plane. We were 14 different cities one season. We were in 14 different cities. How do you be a student and play 32 games? And what a coincidence, the basketball season goes all the way up until like March now, and it starts in November.
All right,
but
Doug, thanks.
You're a full-time student.
And again, I it doesn't sound like you want to give the name of your institution, but where did you go to school?
But one of the things is a accounting student can transfer and go to another college to be a accounting student. But if you're an athlete, you lose a year of eligibility.
All right, Doug. Thanks. Lowberg.
Just to point out that, and then if they get caught, they lose eligibility.
Yeah.
They get punished.
Andrew Zimbalist on the problem that Doug described.
Yeah. Yes. What are my comments on it?
Well, yeah. I mean, how as you've studied the business of sports, and we've heard all of these kinds of stories, some of them took place at Ohio State this year. There have been issues, of course, with USC in the past. How prevalent is the situation that Doug just described?
Well, as far as we know, it's very prevalent. Part of the problem here is that the NCAA, even though it's an institution that has $700 million plus in income annually, they allocate enough money to have about 10 gumshoes, 10 investigators, to cover the whole country. There are 1,100 schools plus in the NCAA. The guy who was the head of enforcement for many years at the NCAA, David Burst, made a comment and said that every single day in college sports, there are 10 significant violations. They don't allocate the resources for these investigators to go out and look for anything. The investigators only end up pursuing cases that are brought to their attention, usually by media leaks, or sometimes by another school will leak something. So they don't go out there and look for these cases, obviously. We just saw a major corruption scandal with the Fiesta Bowl that came out yesterday. These things are all over the place. But it's only the rare case where we find out what's actually going on.
There's a testy exchange in your story, Lowell Bergman, between you and Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, where you're pushing him on how much money he actually makes, and he doesn't want to answer the question. Is part of what we're hearing and learning that an awful lot of money is spent on the people who run the business of big-time college athletics, but that, as Andrew Zimbalist suggests, maybe some of that money ought to be best applied in other ways?
Well, there's a testy exchange, and by the way, there's more of it online. What I found very surprising about it is that, and it's pointed out to him in the interview, parts of the interview that you won't see but is online, is that this is a nonprofit tax-deductible institution. How much he makes, we will know this summer. He's the new president. They have to file a 990 for him, and yet he didn't want to talk about it. He finally acknowledged in the interview that he's allowed, in addition to being president of the NCAA, to collect approximately $350,000 a year in the directorships of two major corporations. So he's free, along with various perks involving travel, country clubs, and so on, to live that kind of lifestyle. 90% of that money is coming from March Madness that pays him. So it's a pretty, I don't think it's really a question here that there's an imbalance in terms of remuneration in this particular industry.
A couple of emails coming in. I'll read. Antoine writes in, the gentleman who was just talking, not sure what his name is, but what he was saying is that these coaches recruit these players, not thinking that these players will someday play a big role in the success of the program. All players are recruited for that purpose, and they should be paid because they generate the revenue. But someone else writes in, isn't it enough that they get a free education for doing something they love? If we're going to siphon and shift revenue, why not use it for scholarship programs or to lower general tuition in general or some other mechanism by which to advance education? Andrew Zimbalist, what about the possibility of somehow tying graduation rates to the amount of money that people receive back from the NCAA, or tying graduation rates to their eligibility to participate in the NCAA tournament? Are those the kinds of things that might make a difference?
Not too much, I don't think. Miles Brand, the former president of the NCAA, who, by the way, earned, we know, $1.7 million in his last year, he did do some of the things that you're suggesting. He put in place a graduation rate system whereby if a school didn't meet certain standards, and roughly it was equivalent to a 50% graduation rate, if they didn't meet those standards, that they would lose some of the scholarships that they were allotted for particular sports. It was a very light penalty, however. I think the problem, Dave, with moving in that direction, and we saw this a little bit when Miles put his system in place, is that all the schools are going to do is they're going to spend more money on tutors, they're going to create more rinky-dink classes, and they're going to make sure that they find teachers who are willing to give these players Cs so that they can keep their eligibility. It's not going to change the substance, the underlying substance, because, look, most of these kids who are going to college are doing it not because they want to be in college, not because they're prepared for college, but because they think that they have a future in professional sports. And say they don't go to college to study, and even if they did, it would be questionable how they would be able to do in the class. And then on top of that, you're having them spend 40 hours plus a week working on very grueling physical activities involved in basketball or in football. So I don't think window dressing by saying, okay, we'll take away a scholarship or we'll take away two scholarships if your graduation rate falls below X or Y, I don't think that's a real solution to the issue here.
Andrew Zimbalist, economics professor at Smith College. Again, his book, Circling the Bases, Essays on the Challenges and Prospects of the Sports Industry. Let's hear from another athlete. Alex Pribble has joined us. He is the Tamalpais High School varsity boys basketball coach and also a four-year basketball player and graduate assistant coach at the University of California, Berkeley. Alex, thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
What's your point of view on this in terms of whether or not you think athletes should be compensated in an additional way, whether or not college athletes should be paid? As someone who played on a big-time college basketball program, what would you like to see change, if anything, about the current system?
Well, I have a few different feelings on it. First off, I don't believe there's any way to pay athletes. I just don't believe that collegiate athletes being paid is going to agree in any way with fulfilling the educational mission of any of the universities. I also don't believe there's any way to determine the value or a market price for these players. To take my experience as an example, I was a walk-on for 2 years where, wasn't generating virtually any revenue, I'm sure, for a university. And then by my junior and senior year, I was starting and getting some playing time, and, maybe my value, so to speak, would have changed. I just don't believe that there's a way to actually determine the value of an athlete and change that year by year.
Do you feel like you got a fair deal, Alex Pribble, for your experience at Cal?
I do. I feel like I was able to take advantage of my education, but to be honest, taking a look at those graduation rates and taking a look at my own teammates who are no longer professional athletes or who tried to venture into the professional field and were turned away, there's no support systems in place for them beyond college. Some of these players have left early to go to the NBA or to go play professionally. And if they were hurt, if they were unsuccessful for whatever number of reasons that they might have been unsuccessful, there's no true support program beyond. They can't come back and fulfill their education. They can't come back and earn a degree at a later date. you know, as someone mentioned earlier on the program, it's a year-by-year guarantee for the contract. So
yeah.
a student-athlete gets hurt, and that's really the end for them. There's no scholarship anymore. There's no opportunity for them to receive the education and to be reimbursed for what they're providing for the university.
How seriously did you and your teammates take school?
Well, you know, in my situation, it was a little bit different. I wasn't treated the same way as many of my teammates coming into university because of my walk-on status. But to take a look at my teammates and the experiences they came through, you know, this begins at a much younger age. The issue isn't necessarily once they're in college. The issue is what they're dealing with when they're youth, you know. From 6th, 7th, 8th grade, you know, all the way through their high school careers, these kids are being told that they're special, that they're NBA prospects, that they're going to make a living playing professional basketball. And so when they're going into their classes, when they're actually on college campus, they, you know, they have those feelings in their mind. They don't take their academics or their education seriously because, you know, what they've been told from a very young age is that they're professional athletes. And so with that in mind, you know, I feel bad for many of my former teammates who believed with all their heart that they were professional basketball players, and when it didn't work out for whatever reason, they're kind of left out to dry. You know, a lot of my teammates right now are trying to scrape out day-to-day professional contracts overseas or trying to re-enter the coaching scene, but the ones who aren't able to do that, there's no support system in place for these athletes who gave so much to the university, 5 hours, 6 hours a day, and, it, you know, received nothing in return in terms of that actual education that they were promised.
Alex Pribble, he's the coach of the basketball. Hang on 1 second, Sonny. Alex Pribble coaches basketball today at Tamalpais High School in the North Bay, former Cal basketball player. Alex, thanks so much for adding in your perspective. Sonny, you wanted to add something?
Yes, Alex, I admire what you and thousands of other kids like you have done. There's no question about it. The one question I'll ask of Alex and others is, did the university that these kids were not prepared to go into, they were accepted into these universities and recruited by these coaches. Just so we understand it, Alex, I understand where you're coming from, and I've seen the same kids, you know, a thousandfold, okay? I'm not disputing your facts and your feelings. They're absolutely true. The one where they can't come back is ridiculous. When they get hurt, there's no more support. Alex is absolutely right on this subject. But my question has always been, all the negatives that are brought up in this recruiting situation that we have, the school, the great universities, and these great coaches accept them. Why don't they have enough integrity to say, you know what, you're not going to do good at the University of X?
Sonny, thanks. Let me let Alex respond. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, please. You know, as a graduate assistant coach at Cal, I was exposed to this firsthand, and I tell you what, that's where the gray area comes in, because it's supposedly an amateur situation for the athletes, but it's clearly a professional situation where the paycheck, where, you know, the support for their own family is at stake here in terms of for the coaches and the athletic directors and the, you know, the professionals in this industry. So, to be honest, as a high school coach right now, it's very easy for me to make decisions based on what's best for the kid. You know, if it comes down to a win or a kid's livelihood, there's no question. I'm you know, sticking my neck out for the benefit of the kid. Not, you know, 10 out of 10 times. But when it comes to colleges and a coach, you know, any number of coaches at the Division I level is faced with recruiting a player who could potentially put a couple more wins on the board, which is going to raise their contract.
And did you see that, Alex, at Cal? Were there kids there who really shouldn't have been there but were there in order to boost the performance of the team only and not there really as students?
Well, you can take a look at what the entry requirements are for these players. You know, obviously, a lot of the student-athletes aren't prepared with the same academic qualifications as the regular student body there. But that's not to say that the athletes on campus didn't take their academics seriously. I think that, you know, they all had a good head on their shoulders. They obviously have a good work ethic there, you know, understand how to manage their time, all qualities that they've taken from the basketball court, all things that they've learned, that they've been educated from their experiences on the court. But, you know, they've been told since they were 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th graders that they're NBA basketball players.
Yeah.
And when your family's telling you it, and when your coaches are telling you it, and when your teammates are telling you it, it's tough to you know, want to get up for that 8 a.m. class when you know you have 6 hours of practice after
right.
that. So,
Alex, thank you. Thanks for adding your perspective, and thanks for the values that you're clearly trying to communicate in your work as a high school basketball coach today. Alex, thank you. Lowell, you wanted to chime in on something that Alex was saying earlier.
Well, also just to reflect that in our research and reporting, we found that only two teams in the history of the NCAA have been, in modern times, have been disqualified for lack of academic performance in terms of competing.
So even though there are certain standards that were supposed to – Andrew Zimbalist was saying there were supposed to be certain penalties in place. You're saying that in reality, those penalties actually don't get enacted?
Well, apparently not. And I think the other thing is that the consensus is not – from our reporting is that it's not so much to pay the players while they're in school, although maybe the scholarship should actually sustain them. But that they create value afterwards, which is what Sonny Vaccaro was talking about. And that's taken by the NCAA and the institution and not set aside, let's say, in case they get injured or in case they don't get further employment or send them back to school.
And that's the other point that Alex Pribble was making. Once those athletes are gone and go on to try professional sports without having finished their degree, there's no support for them to come back and do that. They could come back in, but they wouldn't get the support necessary
to
finish
their degree. They wouldn't be
admitted. Right. And let's hear from some other listeners. Stephanie, go ahead, please. Stephanie,
yeah,
are you with us? Go ahead.
I am with you, yes. My name is Stephanie, and I am an internist, and I also work in chronic pain in Oakland. And I see basically the ramifications of, you know, the end of lives of all of these guys that go to college, that start off with you know, being promised all of this stuff, injure their shoulders, inevitably 90% of them, their knees, tear their medial menisci. By the time that they're 22 years old, they're being told that they need a total knee replacement bilaterally, their hips are shot, their shoulders are shot, and basically they can't even grip anything anymore. They have chronic pain, and as soon as their dreams have been dashed, they get kicked out. And whereas we have compensation for people who are injured on the job for the rest of their life, we have future medical forever for these people. We have future medical for VA patients that go to war. We have no future medical for these athletes that are making, you know, the coaches millions of dollars.
Stephanie,
it's
thanks.
Insane.
Yeah, thanks for the observation. What about that issue of workers' comp, Andrew Zimbalist? Is that something that's come up at all?
Sure, it's come up. Many people argue that since 1973, which was the year the NCAA said that student athletes can only have 1 year scholarships rather than 4 year scholarships, people have argued that that constitutes a quid pro quo in the relationship. That is to say, you play football for me and I'll give you a scholarship, and that creates an employment relationship, and therefore the players should be eligible for workers' comp and other benefits. I wanted to add, if I could, with regard to what Alex said when he was talking about how if a person goes pro and then they hurt themselves and they can't come back, they can't come back to college, they lose their eligibility. It's interesting that the NCAA not only says you can't come back and play college ball if you've been paid to play that sport, but they also say that you lose your eligibility even if you enter a professional draft. So if you enter a professional draft and you don't get drafted until the 10th round, or you get picked by a team you don't want to play for, you can't go back to college. You lose your eligibility. They don't allow students who are in college to even sign up with a lawyer or an agent, even just to discuss what a professional contract would look like. And this is obviously totally arbitrary. This is not a normal definition of professionalism. You're a professional when you sign a contract and you get paid. But the NCAA has put on these other strictures that are very deleterious to the students. With regard to athletes getting paid after they leave, and it's not just for video games, the O'Bannon suit. There are all sorts of ways in which the athletes' images are used.
Or names on jerseys or whatever.
Films,
yeah.
Names on jerseys. There are 7 or 8 or 9 different instances that the O'Bannon case talks about. Moreover, I would argue, why can't the money that is earned from video games and films and so on, from when the athlete is in college, why can't that money go into an escrow fund so that athletes could use maybe for paying for graduate school or for other purposes down the line? Then you're still not paying them while they're students. All of this would be consistent with saying they're amateurs and they don't get paid while they're amateurs. In terms of the question that Sonny asked about why do the colleges even put up with this? Why can't there be more integrity? Well, look, the average college president has a million things that he or she has to worry about that has nothing to do with athletics. The college presidents who have tried to reform the athletic system have been shown the door. They can't. The only college presidents who get involved in the NCAA are people who are sports lovers, and they like to be involved in high-level and commercialized athletics. So the whole structure of the system and the incentives in the system are such that this thing gets perpetuated, and it grows without stop.
Let's hear from one more caller. Emily in San Francisco joins us next. Emily, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I ran track at a Division III school. I went to Bowdoin College, and I know that you're obviously speaking, focusing on Division I athletes, and I understand the revenue that they built, but just coming from a background in Division III and the amount of time that I know that I put in both to my academics and my athletics without gaining any kind of tuition reimbursement at all. My school didn't provide athletic scholarships as Division III schools don't. I think this argument is just creating another slippery slope. If you then were to put out there, okay, Division I athletes, and maybe it's just certain Division I athletes that get time on television. Is it basketball and football? Is it other Division I?
Right.
That creates an argument, but then beyond that, what about the Division II, Division III athletes? I had a very rigorous course load. I found it very difficult to keep up with the demands, and maybe I wasn't doing a 40-hour week with practices, but I was pulling 30-plus a lot of weeks, and I was very competitive, and I went up to the national championship, and I was actually putting in probably 40-plus hours worth of practice time then.
Emily, let me hold you there, if I might. Yeah. Sorry to jump in on you, but we're close to being out of time, and I appreciate your call and the point that you make. And again, it's testimony, Lowell Bergman, to the complexity of all of this. There's not only Division I, there's Division II and III, where there aren't scholarships, but people like Emily who are putting in an enormous amount of time. It's tough stuff to sort out. Doing all of the research and the reporting that you have done for this program, do you come down with a sense that there are some specific things that could be done that really would make a difference?
It seems impossible that the NCAA will not increase the remuneration or to athletes on athletic scholarships. But I think the other issue is, why are people getting scholarships? If it's just for athletic skill and not for need, for instance, and not based, let's say, on academic merit as well as need, but it's on athletic skill. So it's clearly just for that purpose. And that has a significant deleterious effect, I think, on the quality of academic institutions generally. And those are issues and questions that I think can be dealt with. And then finally, the University of Chicago is a well-known academic institution. They faced this issue 50 years ago, and they decided only to do Division III.
Lowell Bergman, again, his story, Money and March Madness, will air on the Frontline series on Sunday at 7 o'clock on KQED Television Channel 9. More sports in the future that you'll be reporting on, Lowell?
I think you'll see some more on PBS because we don't televise football or basketball.
Lowell Bergman, thanks for being with us. Joining us as well, Andrew Zimbalist from Smith College and Sonny Vaccaro, both part of Lowell Bergman's story, too. Thanks both for joining us. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.